Chapter 2. What have we done to our soldiers? The rationalization of killing and how it failed in Vietnam. The rationalization and acceptance of killing. Quote, "But after the fires and the wrath, but after searching and pain, his mercy opens us a path to live with ourselves again." Rudyard Kipling, The Choice. We have previously examined the killing response stages of concern, killing acceleration, remorse, and rationalization and acceptance. Let us now apply this model to the Vietnam veteran in order to understand how the process of rationalization and acceptance of killing failed in Vietnam. The rationalization process. Something unique seems to have occurred in the rationalization process available to the Vietnam veteran. Compared with earlier American wars, the Vietnam conflict appears to have reversed most of the processes traditionally used to facilitate the rationalization and acceptance of killing experiences. These traditional processes involve constant praise and assurance to the soldier from peers and superiors that he did the right thing. One of the most important physical manifestations of this affirmation is the awarding of medals and decorations. The constant presence of mature, older comrades, that is, in their late 20s and 30s, who serve as role models and stabilizing personality factors in the combat environment. A careful adherence to such codes and conventions of warfare by both sides, such as the Geneva Conventions, first established in 1864, thereby limiting civilian casualties and atrocities. Rear lines, or clearly defined safe areas, where the soldier can go to relax and depressurize during a combat tour. The presence of close, trusted friends and confidants who have been present during training and are present throughout the combat experience. A cool-down period as the soldier and his comrades sail or march back from the wars. Knowledge of the ultimate victory of their side and of the gain and accomplishments made possible by their sacrifices. Parades and monuments. Reunions and continued communication via visits, mail, and so on, with the individuals whom the soldier bonded with in combat. An unconditionally warm and admiring welcome by friends, family, communities, and society, constantly reassuring the soldier that the war and his personal acts were for a necessary, just, and righteous cause. And the proud display of medals. What made Vietnam different? In the case of the Vietnam veteran, all but the first of these rationalization processes were not only mostly absent, but many of them were inverted and became sources of great pain and trauma to the veteran. The Teenage War. Quote, "It's easier if you catch them young. You can train older men to be soldiers. It's done in every major war. But you can never get them to believe that they like it, which is the major reason armies try to get their recruits before they're 20. There are other reasons too, of course, like the physical fitness, lack of dependence, and economic dispensability of teenagers that make armies prefer them. But the most important qualities teenagers bring to basic training are enthusiasm and naivete. The armed forces of every country can take almost any young male citizen and turn him into a soldier with all the right reflexes and attitudes in only a few weeks. Their recruits usually have no more than 20 years' experience of the world, most of it as children, while the armies have had all of history to practice and perfect their technique." Gwyn Dyer, War. The combatants of all wars are frightfully young, but the American combatants in Vietnam were significantly younger than any war in American history. Most were drafted at 18 and experienced combat during one of the most malleable and vulnerable stages of their lives. This was America's first teenage war, with the average combatant having not yet seen his 20th birthday. And these combatants were without the leavening of mature, older soldiers that has always been there in past wars. Developmental psychologists have identified this stage in an adolescent's psychological and social development as being a crucial period in which the individual establishes a stable and enduring personality structure and a sense of self. In past wars, the impact of combat on adolescents has been buffered by the presence of older veterans who can serve as role models and mentors throughout the process. But in Vietnam, there were precious few such individuals to turn to. By the end of the war, many sergeants were coming out of shake-and-bake school and had only a few months more training and maturity than their comrades. Even many officers were coming out of OCS, Officer Kennedy School, without any college training whatsoever, and they too had little more training and maturity than their soldiers. They were teenagers leading teenagers in a war of endless small unit operations, trapped together in a real-world reenactment of the Lord of the Flies with guns, and destined to internalize the horrors of combat during one of the most vulnerable and susceptible stages of life. The Dirty War. Simultaneously, everyone leveled his weapon at him and fired. "Jesus Christ," someone gasped behind me, as we watched his body reverse course back toward the trees. Chunks of meat and bone flew through the air and stuck to the huge boulders. One of our rounds detonated a grenade the soldier carried, and his body smashed to the ground beneath a shower of blood. The young Viet Cong was a good soldier, even if he was a communist. He died for what he believed in. He was not a gunner for Hanoi. He was a VC. His country was not North Vietnam. He was South Vietnamese. His political beliefs did not coincide with those of the Saigon government, so he was labeled an enemy of the people. A young Vietnamese girl appeared out of nowhere and sat down next to one of the dead VC. She just sat there staring at the pile of weapons and slowly rocking herself back and forth. I couldn't tell if she was crying because she never once looked over at us. She just sat there. A fly crawled along her cheek, but she paid no attention to it. She just sat there. She was the 7-year-old daughter of a Viet Cong soldier, and I wondered if she had been conditioned to accept death and war and sorrow. She was an orphan now, and I wondered if there were confusion in her mind, or sadness, or just an emptiness that no one could understand. I wanted to go over and comfort her, but I found myself walking down the hill with the others. I never looked back. Nguyễn Hoernick, Battle of Blood. At a Vietnam Vets Coalition meeting in Florida, one vet told me about his cousin, who was also a veteran, who would only say, "They trained me to kill. They sent me to Vietnam. They didn't tell me that I'd be fighting kids." For many, this is the distilled essence of the horror of what happened in Vietnam. The killing is always traumatic. But when you have to kill women and children, or when you have to kill men in their homes in front of their wives and children, and when you have to do it not from 20,000 feet but up close, where you can watch them die, the horror appears to transcend description or understanding. Much of the war in Vietnam was conducted against an insurgent force, against men, women, and children who were often defending their own homes and who were dressed in civilian clothing. This resulted in a deterioration of traditional conventions and an increase in civilian casualties, atrocities, and resultant trauma. Neither the ideological reasons for the war nor the target population was the same as that associated with previous wars. The standard methods of on-the-scene rationalization fail when the enemy's child comes out to mourn over her father's body, or when the enemy is a child throwing a hand grenade. And the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong understood this. Among the many excellent narratives gained from personal interviews in Al Santoli's book, To Bear Any Burden, is the story of Trong My Le, a former Viet Cong agent in the Mekong Delta. "Children were trained," said My Le, "to throw grenades, not only for the terror factor, but so the government or American soldiers would have to shoot them. Then the Americans feel very ashamed, and they blame themselves and call their soldiers war criminals." And it worked. When a soldier shoots a child who is throwing a grenade, the child's weapon explodes, and there is only the mutilated body left to rationalize. There is no convenient weapon indisputably telling the world of the victim's lethality and the killer's innocence. There is only a dead child speaking mutely of horror and innocence lost. The innocence of childhood, soldiers, and nations, all lost in a single act, reenacted countless times for 10 endless years until a weary nation finally retreats in horror and dismay from his long nightmare. The Inescapable War. Quote, "There were no real lines of demarcation, and just about any area was subject to attack. It was an endless war with invisible enemies, and no ground gains, just a constant flow of troops in and out of the country. The only observable outcome was an interminable production of maimed, crippled bodies and countless corpses." Jim Goodwin, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorders. In the face of battle, John Keegan traces conflicts across the centuries, noting in particular how the duration of a battle and the depth of the battlefield increased over the years. From a duration of a few hours and a depth of only a few hundred yards in the Middle Ages, battle grew to the point where, in the 20th century, the depth of the danger zone extended for miles into the rear areas. And the battles could last for months, even blending into one another to create one endless conflict that would last for years. In World War I and World War II, we discovered that this endless battle would take a horrendous psychological toll on the combatant. And we were able to deal with this endless battle by rotating soldiers into the rear lines. Within Vietnam, the danger zone increased exponentially. And for 10 years, we fought a war unlike any we had experienced before. In Vietnam, there were no rear lines to escape to. There was no escape from the stress of combat. And the psychological stress of continuously existing at the front took an enormous, if delayed, toll. The Lonely War. Prior to Vietnam, the American soldier's first experience with the battlefield was usually as a member of a unit that had been trained and bonded together prior to combat. The soldier in these wars usually knew that he was in for the duration or until he had established sufficient points on some type of scale that kept track of his combat exposure. Either way, the end of combat for him was at some vague point in an uncertain future. Vietnam was distinctly different from any war we had fought before or since, in that it was a war of individuals. With very few exceptions, every combatant arrived in Vietnam as an individual replacement on a 12-month tour, 13 months for the U.S. Marines. The average soldier had only to survive his year in hell, and thus, for the first time, had a clear-cut way out of combat other than as a physical or psychological casualty. In this environment, it was far more possible, even natural, that many soldiers would remain aloof, and their bonding would never develop into the full, mature, lifelong relationships of previous wars. This policy, combined with the use of drugs, maintenance of proximity to the combat zone, and establishment of an expectancy of returning to combat, resulted in an all-time low number of psychiatric casualties in Vietnam. Military psychiatrists and leaders believed that they had found a solution for the age-old problem of battlefield psychiatric casualties, a problem that, at one point in World War II, was creating casualties faster than we could replace them. Given a less traumatic war and an unconditionally positive World War II-style welcome to the returning veteran, this might have been an acceptable system. But in Vietnam, what appears to have happened is that many a combatant simply endured the traumatic experiences that might otherwise have been unbearable, by refusing to come to terms with his grief and guilt, and turned instead to the escapist therapy of a short-timer's calendar and the promise of only 45 days and a wake-up. This rotation policy, combined with the extensive use of psychiatrically and self-prescribed drugs, did create an environment in which the incidence of psychiatric casualties on the battlefield was much lower than that of past wars in the 20th century. But a tragic long-term price, a price that was far too high, was paid for the short-term gains of this policy. World War II soldiers joined for the duration. A soldier may have come into combat as an individual replacement, but he knew that he would be with his unit for the rest of the war. He was very invested in establishing himself with his newfound unit, and those who were already in the unit had equal cause to bond with this individual, who they knew would be their comrade until the war was over. These individuals developed very mature, fulfilling relationships that for most of them have lasted throughout their lives. In Vietnam, most soldiers arrived on the battlefield alone, afraid, and without friends. A soldier joined a unit where he was an FNG, an effing new guy, whose inexperience and incompetence represented a threat to the continued survival of those in the unit. In a few months, for a brief period, he became an old hand, who was bonded to a few friends and able to function well in combat. But then, all too soon, his friends left him via death, injury, or the end of their tours. And he too became a short-timer, whose only concern was surviving until the end of his tour of duty. Unit morale, cohesion, and bonding suffered tremendously. All but the best of units became just a collection of men experiencing endless leavings and arrivals. And that sacred process of bonding, which makes it possible for men to do what they must do in combat, became a tattered and torn remnant of the support structure experienced by veterans of past American wars. That does not mean that no bonds were forged, for men will always forge strong bonds in the face of death. But they were few and all too fleeting, destined never to last longer than a year and usually much less than that. The First Pharmacological War. One of the major factors that combined with the rotation policy to suppress or delay dealing with the psychological trauma was the use of a powerful new family of drugs. Soldiers in past wars often drank themselves into numbness, and Vietnam was no exception. But Vietnam was also the first war in which the forces of modern pharmacology were directed to empower the battlefield soldier. The administration of tranquilizing drugs and phenothiazines on the combat front first occurred in Vietnam. The soldiers who became psychiatric casualties were generally placed in psychiatric care facilities in close proximity to the combat zone, where these drugs were prescribed by MDs and psychiatrists. The soldiers under their care readily took their medicine, and this program was touted as a major factor in reducing the incidence of evacuation of psychiatric casualties. In the same way, many soldiers self-prescribed marijuana and, to a lesser extent, opium and heroin to help them deal with the stress they were facing. At first, it appeared that this widespread use of illegal drugs had no negative psychiatric result. But we soon came to realize that the effect of these drugs was much the same as the effect of the legally prescribed tranquilizers. Basically, whether legally or illegally used, these drugs combined with a one-year tour, with the knowledge that all you had to do was gut out 12 months to escape, to submerge or delay combat stress reactions. Tranquilizers do not deal with psychological stressors. They merely do what insulin does for a diabetic. They treat the symptoms, but the disease is still there. Drugs may help make an individual more susceptible to some forms of therapy, if therapy is available. But if drugs are given while the stressor is still being experienced, then they will arrest or supersede the development of effective coping mechanisms, resulting in an increase in the long-term trauma from the stress. What happened in Vietnam is the moral equivalent of giving a soldier a local anesthetic for a gunshot wound and then sending him back into combat. At their best, these drugs only served to delay the inevitable confrontation with the pain, suffering, grief, and guilt that the Vietnam veteran repressed and buried deep inside him. And at worst, they actually increased the impact of the trauma suffered by the soldier. The uncleansed veteran. The traditional cool-down period, while marching or sailing home in intact units, forms a kind of group therapy that was not available to the Vietnam veteran. This, too, is essential to the mental health of the returning veteran. And this, too, was denied the American veteran of Vietnam. Arthur Hadley is a master of military psychological operations, PSYOPs, author of the excellent book Straw Giant, and one of the 20th century's great military intellects. After his tour as a PSYOP commander in World War II, for which he was awarded 2 Silver Stars, Hadley conducted an extensive study on major warrior societies around the world. In this study, he concluded that all warrior societies, tribes, and nations incorporate some form of purification ritual for their returning warriors. And this ritual appears to be essential to the health of both the returning warrior and the society as a whole. Gabriel understands and fully illustrates the role of this purification ritual and the price of its absence. Societies have always recognized that war changes men, that they are not the same after they return. That is why primitive societies often require soldiers to perform purification rites before allowing them to rejoin their communities. These rites often involved washing or other forms of ceremonial cleansing. Psychologically, these rituals provided soldiers with a way of ridding themselves of stress and the terrible guilt that always accompanies the sane after war. It was also a way of treating guilt by providing a mechanism through which fighting men could decompress and relieve their terror without feeling weak or exposed. Finally, it was a way of telling the soldier that what he did was right, and that the community for which he fought was grateful, and that above all, his community of sane and normal men welcomed him back. Modern armies have similar mechanisms of purification. In World War II, soldiers en route home often spent days together on troop ships. Among themselves, the soldiers could relive their feelings, express grief for lost comrades, tell each other about their fears, and above all, receive the support of their fellow soldiers. they were provided with a sounding board for their own sanity. Upon reaching home, soldiers were often honored with parades or other civic tributes. They received the respect of their communities, as stories of their experiences were told to children and relatives by proud parents and wives. All this served the same cleansing purpose as the rituals of the past. When soldiers are denied these rituals, they often tend to become emotionally disturbed. Unable to purge their guilt or be reassured that what they did was right, they turn their emotions inward. Soldiers returning from the Vietnam War were victims of this kind of neglect. There were no long troopship voyages where they could confide in their comrades. Instead, soldiers who had finished their tour of duty were flown home to arrive back in the world, often within days and sometimes within hours of their last combat with the enemy. There were no fellow soldiers to meet them and to serve as a sympathetic sounding board for their experiences, no one to convince them of their own sanity. Since Vietnam, several different returning armies have applied this vital lesson. The British troops returning from the Falklands could have been airlifted home, but instead they made the long, dreary, and therapeutic South Atlantic crossing with their navy. In the same way, Israel addressed the need for a cool-down period among their soldiers returning from the nation's extremely unpopular 1982 incursion into Lebanon. They were aware that in the United States there occurred what some have termed a conspiracy of silence in discussing the Vietnam War and its moral issues upon its conclusion. Recognizing this problem and the need for psychological decompression, the Israelis did what was probably one of the healthiest things they could have done for the mental welfare of those who participated in their Vietnam. According to Shalit, the withdrawing Israeli soldiers were gathered by unit in meetings in which they could relax for the first time after many months. There they went through a lengthy process of ventilating their feelings, questions, doubts, and criticisms about all issues, from the failure of military action and planning to the unnecessary sacrifice of life and the feelings of total failure. And the U.S. troops deployed to Grenada, Panama, Afghanistan, and Iraq left these regions in intact units. The continued stability of these units after departing the combat zone ensured that detailed and psychologically essential after-action briefings and reviews could be conducted at home stations. The defeated veteran. The Vietnam veteran's belief in the justice of his cause and the necessity for his acts was constantly challenged and ultimately bankrupt when South Vietnam fell to an invasion from the North in 1975. A dim foreshadowing of this form of trauma can be seen in World War I, when the war ended without the unconditional surrender of the enemy, and many veterans bitterly understood that it wasn't really over there. With the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, it might be legitimately argued that we did not lose in Vietnam any more than we lost in the Battle of the Bulge. We got pushed back for a while, but ultimately we won the war. But today, such a perspective is small consolation to the Vietnam vet. For the Vietnam veteran, there is no walking Flanders Field, no reenactment of D-Day, no commemoration of Incheon, or any other celebration by grateful nations whose peace and prosperity was preserved by American blood and sweat and tears. For too many years, the Vietnam veterans knew only the defeat of a nation they fought and suffered for, and the victory of a regime that many of them believed to be evil and malignant enough to risk dying to fight against. Ultimately, they have been vindicated. The containment policy that they were an instrument of has been successful. Now the Russians themselves will concede the evils of communism. Hundreds of thousands of boat people attest to the disastrous nature of the North Vietnamese regime. Now the Cold War has ended in victory. And from one perspective, we were no more defeated in Vietnam than the U.S. forces were in the Philippines or the Battle of the Bulge. They lost the battle, but they won the war. And the war was worth fighting. Perhaps we can see Vietnam from that perspective now. And I believe that there is truth and healing in that perspective. But for most Vietnam veterans, this victory comes more than two decades too late. Unwelcome veterans and unmourned dead. Two sources of public recognition and affirmation vital to the soldier are the parades that have traditionally welcomed them home from combat and the memorials and monuments that have commemorated and mourned their dead comrades. Parades are an essential rite of passage to the returning veteran in the same way that bar mitzvahs confirmations, graduations, weddings, and other public ceremonies are to other individuals at key points of their lives. Memorials and monuments mean to the grieving veteran what funerals and tombstones do to any bereaved loved one. But rather than parades and memorials, the Vietnam veteran, who had only done what society had trained and ordered him to do, was greeted by a hostile environment in which he was ashamed to even wear the uniform and decorations that became such a vital part of who he was. Even the 20-year-late Vietnam Veterans Memorial had to be constructed in the face of the same indignity and misunderstanding that the veterans had endured for so long. Initially, the memorial was not to have the flag and statue traditionally associated with such edifices. Instead, the monument to our nation's longest war was to be just a black gash of shame, with the names of the fallen engraved upon it. It was only after a long and bitter battle that veterans groups were able to get a statue and a flagpole flying the U.S. flag added to their memorial. At their own monument, our veterans had to fight to fly the flag that meant so much to them. The thousands of veterans who wept at the wall and marched with tear-streaked faces at welcome home parades given 2 decades after the fact represented a sincere grieving and a true pain that most Americans did not even know existed. But most of all, it represented reconciliation and healing. The veterans who spurned this reconciliation and get all they need down at the American Legion may simply be those who have withdrawn the most deeply into their shells. And as we will see in our look at PTSD, the cost of that shell is significant. But perhaps they have the right to remain in their shells. And it may be that the society that drove them there has no right to expect reconciliation or forgiveness from them. The Lonely Veteran. The experience of the Vietnam veteran was distinctly different from that of the veterans of previous American wars. Once he completed his tour of duty, he usually severed all bonds from his unit and comrades. It was extremely rare for a veteran to write to his buddies who were still in combat, and, in strong contrast to the endless reunions of World War II veterans, for more than a decade, it was even rarer for two or more of them to get together after the war. In his book, PTSD, A Handbook for Clinicians, Vietnam vet Jim Goodwin hypothesizes, I think correctly, that guilt about leaving one's buddies to an unknown fate in Vietnam probably proved so strong that many veterans were often too frightened to find out what happened to those left behind. 2 decades after the fact, Vietnam veterans were able to get over this survivor guilt and form veterans associations and coalitions. For the Vietnam vet, the post-war years were long, lonely ones. But the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and Memorial Day parades in their honor have fortified and cleansed them, and now they are finally beginning to find the strength and courage to reunite with long-lost brothers and welcome one another home. The Condemned Veteran. Quote, "On returning from Vietnam minus one arm, I was accosted twice by individuals who inquired, 'Where did you lose your arm? Vietnam?' I replied, 'Yes.' The response was, 'Good. Serves you right.'" James W. Wagenbach, quoted in Bob Green, Homecoming. Even more important than parades and monuments are the basic day-to-day attitudes toward the returning veteran. Lord Moran felt that public support was a key factor in the returning veteran's psychological health. He believed that Britain's failure to provide her World War I and World War II soldiers the support they needed resulted in many psychological problems. If Lord Moran could detect a lack of concern and acceptance that had a significant impact on the psychological welfare of World War I and World War II veterans in England, how much greater was the adverse impact of the Vietnam vet's much more hostile homecoming? Richard Gabriel describes the experience. "The presence of a Vietnam veteran in uniform in his hometown was often the occasion for glares and slurs. He was not told that he had fought well, nor was he reassured that he had done only what his country and fellow citizens had asked him to do. Instead of reassurance, there was often condemnation, baby killer, murderer, until he too began to question what he had done, and ultimately his sanity. The result was that at least 500,000, and perhaps as many as 1.5 million, returning Vietnam veterans suffered some degree of psychiatric debilitation called post-traumatic stress disorder, an illness which has become associated in the public mind with an entire generation of soldiers sent to war in Vietnam. As the result of this, Gabriel concludes that Vietnam produced more psychiatric casualties than any other war in American history. Numerous psychological studies have found that the social support system, or lack thereof, upon returning from combat, is a critical factor in the veteran's psychological health. Indeed, social support after war has been demonstrated in a large body of research by psychiatrists, military psychologists, Veterans Administration mental health professionals, and sociologists to be more crucial than even the intensity of combat experience. When the Vietnam War began to become unpopular, the soldiers who were fighting that war began to pay a psychological price for it, even before they returned home. Psychiatric casualties increase greatly when the soldier feels isolated, and psychological and social isolation from home and society was one of the results of the growing anti-war sentiment in the United States. One manifestation of this isolation, noted by numerous authors such as Gabriel, was an increase in Dear John letters. As the war became more and more unpopular back home, it became increasingly common for girlfriends, fiancés, and even wives to dump the soldiers who depended upon them. Their letters were an umbilical cord to the sanity and decency that they believed they were fighting for. And a significant increase in such letters, as well as many other forms of psychological and social isolation, probably account for much of the tremendous increase in psychiatric casualties suffered late in that war. According to Gabriel, early in the war, evacuations for psychiatric conditions reached only 6% of total medical evacuations. But by 1971, the percentage represented by psychiatric casualties had increased to 50%. These psychiatric casualty ratings were similar to home front approval ratings for the war, and an argument can be made that psychiatric casualties can be impacted by public disapproval. The greatest indignity heaped upon the soldier waited for him when he returned home. Many veterans are verbally abused and physically attacked or even spit upon. The phenomenon of returning soldiers being spit on deserves special attention here. Many Americans do not believe, or do not want to believe, that such events ever occurred. Bob Green, a syndicated newspaper columnist, was one of those who believed these accounts were probably a myth. Green issued a request in his column for anyone who had actually experienced such an event to write in and tell about it. He received more than 1,000 letters in response, collected in his book, Homecoming. A typical account is that of Douglas Detmer. I was spat upon in the San Francisco airport. The man who spat on me ran up to me from my left rear, spat, and turned to face me. The spittle hit me on my left shoulder and on my few military decorations above my left breast pockets. He then shouted at me that I was a mother-effing murderer. I was quite shocked and just stared at him. That combat veterans returning from months of warfare should accept such acts without violence is an indication of their emotional state. They were euphoric over finally returning home alive. Many were exhausted after days of travel, shell-shocked, confused, dehydrated, and emaciated from months in the bush, in culture shock after months in an alien land, under orders not to do anything to disgrace their uniform, and deeply worried about missing flights. Isolated and alone, the returning veterans in this condition were sought out and humiliated by war protesters who had learned from experience of the vulnerability of these men. The accusations of their tormentors always revolved around the act of killing. When those who had in any way participated in killing activities were called baby killers and murderers, the result was often deep traumatization and scarring as a result of the hostile and accusing homecoming from the nation for which they had suffered and sacrificed. And this was the only homecoming they were to receive. At worst, open hostility and spittle. At best, as one put it in his letter to Green, an indifference that verged on insouciance. At some level, every psychologically healthy human being who has engaged in or supported killing activities believes that his action was wrong and bad, and he must spend years rationalizing and accepting his actions. Many of the veterans who wrote to Green stated that their letter to him was the first time they had ever spoken about the incident to anyone. These returning veterans had shamefully and silently accepted the accusations of their fellow citizens. They had broken the ultimate taboo. They had killed. And at some level, they felt that they deserved to be spit upon and punished. When they were publicly insulted and humiliated, the trauma was magnified and reinforced by the soldiers' own impotent acceptance of these events. And these acts, combined with their acceptance of them, became the confirmation of their deepest fears and guilt. In the Vietnam veterans manifesting PTSD, and probably in many who don't exhibit PTSD symptoms, the rationalization and acceptance process appears to have failed and is replaced with denial. The typical veteran of past wars, when asked, "Did it bother you?" would answer, as a veteran did to Havokhurst after World War II, "Hell yes. You can't go through that without being influenced." The Vietnam veteran's defensive response to a nation accusing him of being a baby killer and murderer is consistently, as it was to Mantell and has been so many times to me, "No, it never really bothered me. You get used to it." This defensive repression and denial of emotions appear to have been one of the major causes of post-traumatic stress disorder. An agony of many blows. American veterans of past wars have encountered all of these factors at one time or another, but never in American history has the combination of psychological blows inflicted upon a group of returning warriors been so intense. The soldiers of the Confederacy lost their war, but upon their return they were generally greeted and supported warmly by those for whom they had fought. Korean War veterans had no memorials and precious few parades, but they fought an invading army, not an insurgency, and they left behind them the free, healthy, thriving, and grateful nation of South Korea as their legacy. No one spat on them or called them murderers or baby killers when they returned. Only the veterans of Vietnam have endured a concerted, organized psychological attack by their own people. Douglas Detmer shows remarkable insight into the organization and scope of this attack. Opponents of the war used every means available to them to make the war effort ineffective. This was particularly accomplished by usurping many of the traditional symbols of war and claiming them as their own. Among these were the two-fingered V for victory sign, which was claimed as a peace symbol, headlights on Memorial Day used as a call for ending the war, rather than denoting the memory of a lost loved one, utilizing old uniforms as anti-war attire instead of proud symbols of prayer service, legitimate deeds of valor denounced as bully-like acts of murder, and the welcome home parade replaced with what I experienced. Never in American history, perhaps never in all the history of Western civilization, has an army suffered such an agony of many blows from its own people. And today we reap the legacy of those blows in a bitter harvest of PTSD in our Vietnam veterans. I will leave it to the reader to make your own best judgment and proper application of these bitter lessons to current and future wars. But I hope that no sane person can deny the urgent need to constantly apply the lessons of that tragic war in the decades and centuries to come.